J.K. Rowling. Her books have quite literally been burned.
There's a new job in the publishing business. It's known as a sensitivity reader.
Who scan texts before publication on the lookout for any missteps.
The censors are kind of insatiable and they'll always find something new to go after.
And presumably there's an incentive to censor.
They're the ones who are constantly saying literature is racist, literature is sexist. They are arsonists who sell fire insurance.
Hello, I'm Fraser Myers, deputy editor of Spikes. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Adam Steller, the author of This Book Is Dangerous. Welcome, Adam.
Hey, Fraser. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Adam, your book is about the kind of hidden censorship that's going on all the time in the publishing industry. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about maybe some of the more public scandals first that have broken forth. It seems to concern a lot of young adult fiction where rows have led to some quite serious cases of censorship. Could you talk a bit about that at first?
One of the things that my book looks at is how a moral panic that really started over children's literature and what's called young adult literature. So this would be like preteen, teen, sort of coming of age literature. And, it looks at how these controversies that began there and began under this sort of guise of protecting young people. You know, this has eventually spread to adult literature, even to places like the New York Times, et cetera. So, to your question, yeah, there's been a ton of public controversies. And that's kind of how I got interested in this. So like, you know, some of the more major ones, there was a young adult novel called Blood Air that was supposed to come out in early 2019. It got accused of cultural appropriation and racism. Publisher actually canceled it, sent it to sensitivity readers, sent it, you know, published it as a later date. A few months later, there was another young adult author who actually went after that first author, who then saw his book canceled for not being sensitive enough. And that guy is actually a sensitivity reader too. So he's someone who's brought on to make books more sensitive. You know, even, you know, in your neck of the woods, British authors, so J.K. Rowling, her books have quite literally been burned by liberals and TikTok videos, who say that she should be dropped by her publisher, that, you know, she should be done for because of her views on the trans stuff. But yeah, it's, you know, eventually this has made it up to, you know, journalistic outlets. So the New York Times Union at one point asked the New York Times to start hiring sensitivity readers to make sure their articles are being more sensitive, even peer-reviewed publications, similar sorts of things. And it's not just things like sensitivity readers, not just canceled books. When you actually start looking at contract changes, especially in the publishing world, so like the big five publishers, Penguin Random House, HarperCollins, et cetera, you start seeing what's called morality clauses emerging during the period of peak wokeness. And these are basically clauses that allow publishers to drop their authors if there's any sort of social media backlash, anything in that nature. So it's given just even more power to the publishers to sort of protect their bottom line and throw their own authors under the bus.
And you mentioned there the sensitivity readers. People in the UK may have heard of them in relation to, there was a very funny story about Roald Dahl. A new version had been gone through with the sensitivity readers had used the red pen to, you know, take out some of the more spicier character descriptions. But what is a sensitivity reader and where do they come from?
So before I answer that, I'll just note Roald Dahl is a great example because his books have been getting butchered for decades. Mm. You can actually find like sort of an original copy of, for example, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's much different than the copy you'll find today. Like some people don't even know that, you know, originally there were no Oompa Loompas. It was African pygmies. But you know, they're still editing his work. So like, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, they started changing words like, you know, don't describe this character as fat, describe him as, you know, bigger or something like that. You know, the censors are kind of insatiable and they'll always find something new to go after. So a sensitivity reader, the sort of condensed version, it's just someone who shares a quote unquote marginalized identity with a fictional character. So like if I was black, I could be a sensitivity reader for black characters. If I was gay, I could be a sensitivity for gay characters. And it's premised on this idea that if you have characters if you're writing outside your own identity, you need to bring in a sensitivity reader to quote unquote get it right. So like as a white dude, there's this assumption that there's no way I could, you know, accurately represent an African American or an Asian American, or, you know, I'm not trans. I couldn't represent trans characters. So we have to hire these people to come in and evaluate whether we're getting it right, whether we're being culturally authentic, whether we're being sensitive enough. But you don't go to school for this stuff. There's no training. You know, if you go on X right now, you'll see people posting things like, hey, I'm a sensitivity reader for a queer novel. And literally the only, you know, credential they have is that they themselves are queer.
And isn't it quite regressive, actually? You know, if you're essentially asking, or the publishing industry is essentially saying that one, say, black person can speak for all black people and all black experiences. And also, well, why can't you use imagination to write beyond your own experiences of the color of your skin or sexuality or whatever identity group it might be?
So, I mean, one of the great ironies of this moment, and frankly, there are many, particularly in publishing, is that this is being done in the name of anti-racism or in the name of feminism. But what you actually end up getting is, you know, what I would consider actually very racist. So, you know, in America, right, there's about 40 million African Americans. You know, these are people who are progressive, but there's people who voted for Donald Trump and are conservative. You know, there's people who feel this way about trans issues, people who don't feel this way. There's African Americans who grew up in poverty. There's African Americans who grew up in millionaire families. So the idea that any one person could sort of represent that incredibly diverse group of people is frankly preposterous, but their work depends on them being able to do that. So these sensitivity readers, they'll say things like, oh, a black person would never say that, or an Asian American person would never eat that, or, you know, a queer person would never have that view of the Trump administration. But, you know, if you were to say that about white people, for example, it would be immediately become, you know, ridiculous, right? The idea that, you know, a white man would never say that or never do that. But for, you know, these quote unquote marginalized groups, they get tokenized. Mm. The tokenization is happening in the name of progress, in the name of diversity, et cetera.
And presumably there's an incentive to censor. I mean, if you read a book and you're a sensitivity reader and you didn't find anything offensive, wouldn't you be considered a bad sensitivity reader?
Yeah. There's no, you know, there's no need for your work, right? If there's that. And I think the incentive structure actually becomes a lot clearer when you look at the controversies and who is involved in the controversies. So one thing you'll notice is that books that have, and I don't use this metaphorically, books that have quite literally been canceled, books like Blood Air, books like A Place for Wolves, it's often sensitivity readers waging those attacks on Twitter, on Goodreads. They're the ones tweeting at the publisher. They're the ones finding out who an author's agent is and pressing them to drop them. They're the ones who are constantly saying literature is racist, literature is sexist. In many ways, they are arsonists who sell fire insurance in the sense that they're creating the need for their services, because the publishers themselves are very aware of this. They do not want their book to be the subject of ire. And the sensitivity readers are promising them sort of insurance, right? They're saying, you know, we can read your manuscript before it comes out. We can protect it from cancel culture, from the backlash.
And are there any things that are happening internally before, for instance, these controversies blow up, before even perhaps one of the sensitivity readers gets their hands on it? I mean, how insidious is this kind of culture?
Yeah, it's really pervasive. So, you know, I agree that wokeness is certainly dead in certain corners, right? So like in the Oval Office where our president is in the United States, right? Donald Trump is not woke. Mm. You know, wokeness is dead there. But in places like publishers that have historically been left of center, the mainstream ones, it is very much alive and well, just as it's alive and well, you know, in the English department at Oxford or the anthropology department at, you know, Yale University. So inside the publishers, you know, one of the things that my book set out to do was sort of provide an expose of what happens behind closed doors. Because people work in publishing, especially people who cannot stand this stuff, they're very reluctant to speak out about it publicly. So the things you're seeing behind closed doors, everything from acquisition practices, so what books are acquired, to editing policies, it has all been affected by cancel culture. So like to give you some tangible examples, right? So a big thing that has become a source of debate and discussion and self-censorship is immoral characters in literature, right? So you might have a story, right? Let's say it's set in like the early 1800s and you have a character, a white guy who says racist things, who does racist things, right? That is a very, very touchy subject for the publishers right now. Because from their mind, they think, hey, if we're publishing this book and we send out some advanced reading copies, you know, a month before publication and someone screenshots that, and then they post it on X. And, you know, one thing that's very common is if there's a racist character or sexist character, these hyper woke people will just associate that with the author, with the book. So the idea that you yourself could be not racist, but still have a racist character or multiple racist characters, that's a very thin tightrope to walk. So what these publishers will do is they'll actually ask authors to change dialogue, to remove characters, to change characters. And if you absolutely need to, for example, have a character who is sexist or racist or whatever, they want that character to sort of get their comeuppance. So I don't mean like struck by lightning or something like that. I mean, like, if you have a racist character, you need to also have an anti-racist character who's going to like check them and educate them even better if they can get them to change their views. But, you know, the idea that you know, a major publisher would just publish a book where a character is sexist, is homophobic, and, you know, they don't get privilege checked. They just sort of continue on. You know, those books are few and far between. And, you know, that has understandably annoyed authors and agents who don't want to write sort of this morally didactic preening literature.
Yeah. It's kind of like a woke version of the Hayes Code in a way. I mean, I'm pretty sure in the early
20th century, 100%.
You couldn't have films that where the bad guy didn't get his comeuppance, where, where there might be some moral ambiguity. Finally, Adam, do you see any signs of hope or change, or is the publishing industry just one of those places that's slightly too far gone to be rescued?
Yeah, so I'm not particularly hopeful. Like, you know, I could be wrong. I can't predict the future. But what you have to understand is that these are institutions that even before sort of the period that we call wokeness, cancel culture, these were already institutions that were very ideologically homogenous. So when you look at the big five publishers, again, Penguin, Harper, et cetera, you know, they have relatively few like conservative imprints. Like there really is just these very small corners carved out for conservative authors. And that's because publishers, again, have historically been very liberal and very left of center. And because of that, I don't see this changing in any significant way, because they're not really incentivized to change. And what you have to understand is that even if the broader culture, you know, becomes less woke, less cancel culturally, publishing is very much its own culture and has been that way. And, you know, at least the private ones, right? They're not dependent on government funding. Like you can't legislate this stuff away. And the most important thing that I think people need to remember is, as Upton Sinclair, the novelist, said, it's very hard to convince someone of something when their income depends on them not being convinced. So it's not like the sensitivity readers are all of a sudden like, we've solved all the racism, we've solved all the sexism, it's time to retire. If anything, I think especially in the US and around the world, with Donald Trump in power, with some other conservatives in power, these people in publishing who don't have any political power, for them, they think they're enacting sort of resistance and political change by like tightly controlling what they do. I've said this a number of times. I say it in my book, but in the ashes of political defeat, the left's sort of culture war really thrives. Because right now, you know, a lot of this comes out of America. You know, I focus on American companies, but these are international companies, right? Like, so someone I quote in my book, they say, you know, what happens in New York City eventually makes its way to London, because these are all international conglomerates. So, you know, I can definitely see over the next few years, you know, the same sort of stuff that we've been privy to over the past decade, just sort of continuing, right? And an example of this is there was a book that was supposed to come out a few months ago called Sparrow and Vine. It was a romanticy, or a romance book. And that book was canceled before publication because people said that there was a character in it who is too sympathetic to Elon Musk. The character liked Elon Musk. He was inspired by Elon, thought Elon was a smart guy. And people said, no, this is conservative. This is problematic. This book needs to go. And the publisher canceled it, canceled the whole series. So, you know, that author is looking for work. So, no, I don't, you know, I see that and I don't think, I don't have a lot of hope looking at that.
Fair enough. Well, Adam Stella, thank you very much for talking to me.